This is Audible.
Harlequin Teen and Harper Audio present Shadow of the Fox by Julie Kagawa. Performed by Joy Osmansky, Brian Nishi, and Emily Wuzeller. Part 1. 1. Beginnings and Endings. It was raining the day Suki came to the Palace of the Sun, and it was raining the night that she died.
"You're the new maid, are you?"
a woman with a narrow, bony face demanded, looking her up and down. Suki shivered, feeling cold rainwater sliding down her back, dripping from her hair to spatter the fine wood floor. The head housekeeper sniffed.
"Well, you're no beauty, that's for sure. But no matter, Lady Satomi's last maid was pretty as a butterfly with half the wit."
She leaned closer, narrowing her eyes.
"Tell me, girl, they said you were running your father's shop before you came here. Do you have an intelligent head on your shoulders? Or is it as full of air as the last girl's?"
Suki chewed her lip and looked at the floor. She had been helping to run her father's shop within the city for the better part of a year. The only child of a celebrated flute maker, she was often responsible for dealing with the customers when her father was at work, too engrossed in his task to eat or talk to anyone until his latest piece was done. Suki could read and do numbers as well as any boy, but being a girl, she was not allowed to inherit her father's business or learn his craft. Mura Akihito was still strong, but he was getting old, his once nimble fingers stiffening with age and hard use. Rather than marry Suki off, her father had used his meager influence to get her a job in the Imperial Palace, so she would be well taken care of when he passed away. Suki missed home, and she desperately wondered if her father was all right without her. But she knew this was what he wanted.
"I don't know, ma'am," she whispered.
"Well, we'll see soon enough. But I would think of something better to say to Lady Satomi. Otherwise your stay will be even shorter than your predecessor's. Now," she continued, "clean yourself up, then go to the kitchen and fetch Lady Satomi's tea. The cook will tell you where to take it."
A few minutes later, Suki walked down the veranda, carrying a full tea tray and trying to remember the directions she'd been given. The Emperor's Palace of the Sun was a miniature city in itself. The main palace, where the Emperor and his family lived, loomed over everything, but a labyrinth of walls, structures, and fortifications lay between the keep and the inner wall, all designed to protect the Emperor and confuse an invading army. Nobles, courtiers, and samurai paraded to and fro down the walkways, dressed in robes of brilliant color and design, white silk with delicate sakura petals, or a vivid red with golden chrysanthemum blooms. None of the nobles she passed spared her a second glance. Only the most influential families resided this close to the Emperor. The closer you lived to the main keep of the palace, the more important you were. Suki wandered down the maze of verandas, the knots in her stomach growing tighter as she searched in vain for the right quarters. Everything looked the same. Gray-roofed buildings with bamboo and paper walls, and wooden verandas between them so the nobles wouldn't sully their clothes in the dirt and dew. Blue-tiled turrets towered over her in regal splendor, and dozens of different songbirds trilled from the branches of the perfectly groomed trees. But the tightness in Suki's chest and the churning of her insides made it impossible to appreciate any of it. A high, clear note cut through the air, rising above the rooftops, making her freeze in her tracks. It wasn't a bird, though a thrush perched in a nearby bush warbled loudly in reply. It was a sound Suki knew instantly, had memorized each and every note. How many times had she heard it, drifting up from her father's workshop? The sweet, haunting melody of a flute. Mesmerized, she followed the sound, momentarily forgetting her duties, and that her new mistress would almost certainly be very annoyed that her tea was so late. The song drew her forward, a keening, mournful melody, like saying goodbye or watching autumn fade. Suki could tell that whoever was playing the instrument was skilled indeed. So much emotion lay between the notes of the song, it was as if she was hearing someone's soul. So hypnotized was she by the sound of the flute, she forgot to look where she was going. Rounding a corner, Suki squeaked in dismay as a young noble in sky-blue robes blocked her path, a bamboo flute held to his lips. The teapot rattled and the cups shook perilously as she swerved to avoid him, desperately trying not to spill the contents. The sound of the flute ceased as the noble, much to her amazement, turned and put out a hand to steady the tray before it toppled to the veranda.
"Careful there."
His voice was high and clear.
"Don't want to drop anything. That would be an awful mess. Are you all right?"
Suki stared at him. He was the most handsome man she had ever seen. No, not handsome, she decided. Beautiful. His broad shoulders filled the robe he wore, but his features were graceful and delicate, like a willow tree in the spring. Instead of a samurai's topknot, his hair was long and straight, falling well past his shoulders, and was pure white, the color of mountain snow. Even more amazing, he was smiling at her. Not the cold, amused smirk of most nobles and samurai, but a real smile that reached the mirthful crescents of his eyes.
"Please excuse me,"
the man said, releasing the tray and taking a quick step back. His expression was calm, not irritated at all.
"That was my fault, planting myself in the middle of the walk, not thinking anyone could be rushing around the corner with a tea tray. I hope I did not inconvenience you, Miss..."
Suki opened her mouth twice before anything came out.
"Please forgive me, Lord."
Her voice was a whisper. Nobles did not speak like this to peasants. Even she knew that.
"I am Suki, and I am only a maid. Please don't trouble yourself with the likes of me."
The noble chuckled.
"It is no trouble, Suki-san," he said. "I often forget where I am when I'm playing."
He raised the flute, making her heart leap.
"Please, do not think any more of it. You may return to your duties."
He stepped aside for her to pass, but Suki didn't move, unable to tear her gaze from the instrument in his slender hand. It was made of polished wood, dark and rich and straighter than an arrow, with a distinctive band of gold around one end. She knew she shouldn't speak to the noble, that he could order her flogged, imprisoned, even executed if he wished it. But words escaped her all the same.
"You play magnificently, my lord," she whispered. "Forgive me. I know it is not my place to say anything, but my father would be proud."
He cocked his head, a flicker of surprise crossing his beautiful face.
"Your father?"
he asked, as understanding dawned in his eyes.
"You are Mura Akihito's daughter?"
"Hai."
He smiled and gave her the barest of nods.
"The song is only as beautiful as the instrument," he told her. "When you see your father again, tell him that I am honored to possess such a masterpiece."
Suki's throat closed up, and her eyes grew hot and blurry. The noble politely turned away, feigning interest in a cherry blossom tree, giving her time to compose herself.
"Ah, but perhaps you are lost?"
he inquired after a moment, examining a chrysalis on one of the slender branches. Turning back, his slender brows rose, but Suki caught no derision in his stance or voice, only amusement, as one might have when speaking to a wandering cat.
"The Emperor's palace can be dazzling indeed to the uninitiated. Whose quarters are you assigned to, Suki-san? Perhaps I can point you in the right direction."
"Lady Satomi, my lord,"
Suki stammered, truly stunned by his kindness. She knew she should bow, but she was terrified she would spill the tea.
Please forgive me. I have come to the palace only today, and everything is very confusing.
A slight frown crossed the noble's face, making Suki's heart nearly stop in her chest, thinking she had offended him.
I see, he murmured, mostly to himself. Yet another maid, Satomi-san. How many does the Emperor's concubine need?
Before Suki could wonder what that meant, he shook himself and smiled once more.
Well, fortune favors you, Suki-san. Lady Satomi's residence isn't far.
He raised a billowy sleeve, pointing an elegant finger down the walkway.
Go left around this building, then walk straight to the very end. It will be the last doorway on the right.
Leisuke-san!
A woman's voice echoed down the veranda before Suki could even whisper her thanks, and the man turned his beautiful face away. Moments later, a trio of noblewomen in elegant green and gold robes sashayed around the building and gave him mock frowns as they hurried forward.
There you are, Daisuke-san,
one of them huffed.
Where have you been? We are going to be late for Hanoe-san's poetry recital.
Oh, she said, catching sight of Suki.
What is this? Daisuke-san, don't tell me you were here all this time talking to a maid.
And why not?
Daisuke's tone was wry.
A maid's conversation can be as interesting as any noblewoman's.
The three women giggled as if that were the funniest thing they had ever heard. Suki didn't see what was so amusing.
Oh, Taiyo Daisuke, you say the most wicked things!
One of them chided from behind a white fan painted with cherry blossoms.
Come now, we really must go. You,
she said, directing her gaze to Suki.
Get back to your duties. Why are you just standing there gaping? Shoo!
As quickly as she could without spilling the tea, Suki hurried away. But her heart still pounded, and for some reason she couldn't catch her breath.
Taiyo.
Taiyo was the name of the imperial family. Daisuke-sama was of the Sun Clan, one of the most powerful families in Iwagoto. The blood of the emperor himself. The funny feeling in her stomach intensified, and her thoughts became a swarm of moths, fluttering around the dazzling memory of his smile and the melody from her father's flute. Somehow, she found her way to the correct door, at the very end of the veranda, looking over the magnificent gardens of the palace. The shoji panel was open, and Suki could smell the smoky hint of burning incense wafting from the darkened interior. Creeping inside the room, she peered around for her new mistress, but saw no one. Despite the noble's unified preference for simplicity, this apartment was lavishly cluttered. Ornamental screens turned the room into a small maze, and tatami mats lined the entire floor, thick and soft beneath her feet. Paper was everywhere. Origami sheets of every style and texture lay in piles around the apartment. Folded paper birds peered at her from atop every flat surface, dominating the room. Suki brushed a flock of origami cranes from the table so that she could set the tea down.
Mai-chan.
A gossamer voice drifted out of the adjoining room, and the sound of silk rustled over the floor.
Is that you? Where have you been? I was getting worried that you...
A woman appeared in the doorway, and for a moment they stared at one another, Suki's mouth hanging open in amazement. If Taiyo Daisuke was the most handsome man she had ever met, this was the most elegantly beautiful woman in the whole palace. Her billowing robes were red with silver, gold, and green butterflies swarming the front. Shimmering black hair was beautifully styled atop her head, pierced with red and gold chopsticks and ivory combs. Dark eyes and a flawless porcelain face regarded Suki curiously.
Hello,
the woman said, and Suki quickly closed her mouth.
May I inquire as to who you are?
I'm Suki, the girl stammered. I'm your new maid.
I see.
The woman's lips curved in a faint smile. Suki was sure that if her teeth showed, they would light up the room.
Come here, if you would, little Suki-chan. Please don't step on anything.
Suki obeyed, placing her feet carefully to avoid squashing any paper creatures, and stood before Lady Satomi. The woman struck her across the face with her open palm. Pain exploded behind her eye, and she collapsed to the floor, too stunned to even gasp. Blinking back tears, she put her hand to her cheek and gazed blankly up at Lady Satomi, who loomed over her, smiling.
"Do you know why I did that, little Suki-chan?"
she asked. And now she did show her teeth. They reminded Suki of a grinning skull.
No, my lady,
she murmured as her numb cheek started to burn.
Because I called for my chan, not you,
the lady replied in a relentlessly cheerful voice.
You might be a stupid country girl, Suki-chan, but that does not excuse your complete ignorance. You must come only when called. Is that understood?
Yes, my lady.
Smile, Suki-chan,
Satomi suggested.
If you smile, perhaps I can forget you have the accent of a sweaty country barbarian and the face of an ox. It will be dreadfully difficult not to loathe you on sight, but I will do my best. Isn't that generous of me, Suki-chan?
Suki, not knowing what to say to this, kept her mouth shut and thought of Daisuke-sama.
Isn't that generous of me, Suki-chan?
Satomi repeated, an edge to her voice now. Suki swallowed hard.
Hi, Lady Satomi.
Satomi sighed.
You smashed my creations.
She pouted, and Suki glanced down at the origami creatures that had been crushed by her body. The lady sniffed and turned away.
I shall be very angry if you do not replace them. There is a quaint little shop in the Wind District that sells the most delicate lavender sheets. If you run, you should catch them before they close.
Suki gazed through an open screen at the storm clouds roiling above the palace. Thunder rumbled as silver-blue strands chased each other through the sky.
Yes, Lady Satomi.
The passing days made Suki long for her father's shop, for the quiet comfort of sweeping, stitching torn clothing, and cooking meals 3 times a day, for the comforting smell of sawdust and wood shavings, and for the customers who barely gave her a second glance, concerned only with her father and his work. She'd thought it would be easy enough to be the maid to a great lady, to help her dress and run her errands and see to the mundane little tasks that were beneath the notice of the nobility. Perhaps that was how it should have been. Certainly the other maids did not seem to share her plight. Indeed, they seemed to go out of their way to avoid her, as if associating with Lady Satomi's maid would attract the ire of her mistress. Suki couldn't blame them. Lady Satomi was a nightmare. A beautiful nightmare of silk, makeup, and heady perfume. Nothing Suki did suited the woman. No matter how she scrubbed or cleaned, the laundry never met with Satomi's satisfaction. The tea Suki brewed was too weak, too strong, too sweet, always too something. No amount of cleaning sufficed within Lady Satomi's chambers. There was always a speck of dirt to be found, a tatami mat out of place, an origami creature in the wrong spot. And each failure brought a little smile from the lady and a shockingly powerful slap. No one cared, of course. The other maids looked away from her bruises, and the guards did not look at her at all. Suki did not dare complain. Not only was Lady Satomi a great and powerful lady, she was the favored concubine of the emperor himself. To speak poorly of her would be insulting Taiyo no Genjiro, the great son of heaven, and would result in a flogging, public humiliation, or worse. The only thing that saved Suki from complete despair was the thought of running into Daisuke-sama again. He was a great noble, of course, far above her station, and would not care about the troubles of a lowly maid. But even catching a glimpse of him would be enough. She looked for him on the verandas and the paths to and from Lady Satomi's chambers, but the beautiful noble was nowhere to be seen. Later, she learned through servant gossip that Tayo Daisuke had left the Palace of the Sun not long after she arrived, heading off on one of his mysterious pilgrimages across the country. Perhaps, Suki thought, she would catch a glimpse of him when he returned. Perhaps she would hear her father's flute again, and follow it until she found him on the verandas, his long white hair flowing behind him. A ringing slap drew her from her daydream, knocking her to the floor.
"Oh, dear, you are such a clumsy girl."
Lady Satomi stood over her, resplendent in her stunning silk robes.
"Get up, Suki-chan. I have a task for you."
In her arms, the lady carried a coil of fine silken cord, blood red in color. As Suki staggered to her feet, the rope was thrust into her arms.
"You are such a feeble-minded little thing, aren't you? I despair of ever making a good maid out of you. But surely even you can take care of this one small task. Take this rope to the storehouse in the Eastern Gardens, the one past the lake. Surely you can do that much. And do stop crying, girl. What will people think of me if my maid goes around weeping everywhere?"
Suki awoke to darkness with a throbbing in her skull. Her vision swam, and there was a weird coppery taste in the back of her throat. Overhead, thunder growled, and a sharp, ozone-scented wind blew into her face. The floor beneath her felt cold, and hard, stony edges were pressing uncomfortably into her stomach and cheek. Blinking, she tried pushing herself upright, but her arms would not respond. A moment later, she realized they were tied behind her back. Ice flooded her veins. She rolled to her side and attempted to stand, but her knees and ankles were bound as well. With the same rope she'd brought to the storehouse, she realized, and a rag was stuffed into her mouth, tied with a strip of cloth. With a muffled shriek, she thrashed wildly, writhing on the stones. Pain shot up her arms as she scraped along the ground, cutting her skin on rocked edges and leaving bits of flesh behind, but the ropes held firm. Panting, exhausted, she slumped against the stones in defeat, then raised her head to gaze at her surroundings. She lay in the center of a courtyard, but not the pristine, elegant courtyard of the Sun Palace, with its swept white stones and trimmed bushes. This one was dark, rocky, ruined. The castle it was attached to was also dark and abandoned, looming over her like some great sullen beast, tattered banners flapping against the walls. Dead leaves and broken stones were scattered throughout the courtyard, and a samurai's helmet, empty and rusting, lay a few feet from her. In the flickering light overhead, she could see the glint of eyes atop the walls. Dozens of crows, watching her with their feathers spiked out against the wind.
"Hello, Suki-chan,"
said an eerily cheerful voice somewhere behind her.
"Did you finally wake up?"
Suki craned her neck back. Lady Satomi stood a few paces away, her hair unbound and tossed by the wind, the sleeves of her red and black kimono fluttering like sails. Her eyes were hard, and her lips were curled in a tiny smile. Gasping, Suki flopped to a sitting position, wanting to cry for help, to ask what was happening. Was this some terrible punishment for disappointing her mistress, for not cleaning, fetching, or serving to her standards? She tried pleading with her eyes, hot tears leaking down her cheeks, but the woman only wrinkled her nose.
"Such a lazy girl, and so fragile. I cannot abide your constant weeping."
Lady Satomi sniffed and moved a few feet away, not looking at her anymore.
"Well, be happy, Suki-chan, for today your misery will come to an end. Though it will mean I must acquire yet another maid. What is it with all these serving girls running away like mice? Ungrateful wretches.
no sense of responsibility at all.
She gave a long, suffering sigh, then looked at the clouds as lightning flickered and the wind picked up.
Where is that Oni?
She muttered.
After all the trouble I went through for a suitable compensation, I shall be very cross if he does not arrive before the storm.
Oni? Suki must have been hearing things. Oni were great and terrible demons that came from Jigoku, the realm of evil. There were countless stories of brave samurai slaying Oni, sometimes armies of Oni. But they were myths and legends. Oni were the creatures parents threatened wayward children with. Don't wander too close to the woods or an Oni might get you. Listen to your elders, or an Oni will reach up from beneath the floorboards and drag you down to Jigoku. Scary warnings for children and monstrous foes for legendary samurai. But not creatures that walked Ningenkai, the mortal realm. There was a blinding flash, a boom of thunder, and a great horned creature appeared at the edge of the courtyard. Suki screamed. The gag muffled it, but she kept screaming until she was out of breath, gasping and choking into the cloth. She tried to flee and fell hard against the stones, striking her chin on the rock. But she barely felt the pain. Lady Satomi's lips moved as she gave her a withering look, probably chastising her shrillness. But Suki's mind couldn't register anything but the huge demon. For it could only be a thing of nightmares, prowling forward into the torchlight. The monster that shouldn't exist. It was massive, standing a good 15 feet overhead, and just as terrible and fearsome as the legends described. Its skin was a dark crimson, the color of blood, and a wild black mane tumbled down its back and shoulders. Sharp yellow tusks curled from its jaw, and its eyes glowed like hot coals as the demon lumbered forward, making the ground shake. The tiny part of Suki's brain not frozen in terror recalled that in the stories, Oni dressed in loincloths made of great striped beasts. But this demon wore plates of lacquered armor. The red shoulder pads, thigh guards, and bracers of the samurai when they rode into battle. True to the myths, however, it carried a giant, iron-studded club, a tetsubo, in one hand, swinging it to a shoulder as if it weighed no more than an inkstick.
There you are, Yabudama.
Lady Satomi lifted her chin as the Oni stopped in front of her.
I am aware that time in Jigoku doesn't exist, and it is said that one day is akin to 800 years in the mortal realm, but punctuality is a wonderful attribute, something we can all aspire to.
The Oni grunted, a deep, guttural sound emerging between his fangs.
Do not lecture me, human,
it rumbled, its terrible voice making the air shiver.
Calling on Jigoku takes time, especially if you wish to summon an army.
Behind the demon, spreading around him like a colony of ants, a horde of smaller monsters appeared. Standing only a few inches above the knee, their skin different shades of blue, red, and green, they looked like tiny Oni themselves, except for their huge flared ears and maniacal grins. They spotted Suki and began edging forward, cackling and licking their pointed teeth. She shrieked into the gag and tried wiggling away, but got no farther than a landed fish. The Oni growled a warning, deep as distant thunder, and the horde skittered back.
Is that mine?
The demon asked, glowing crimson gaze falling on Suki.
It looks tasty.
He took a step toward her, and she nearly fainted on the spot.
Patience, Yabudama.
Lady Satomi held out a hand, stopping him. He narrowed his eyes and bared his teeth slightly, but the woman didn't seem disturbed.
You can have your payment in a moment, she went on. I just want to make certain you know why you were summoned. That you know what you must do.
How could I not?
the Oni replied, sounding impatient.
The dragon is rising. The harbinger of change approaches. Another 1,000 years have passed in this realm of horrible light and sun, and the night of the wish is nearly upon us. There is only one reason a mortal would summon me into Ningankai at this time.
A look of amused contempt crossed his brutish face.
I will get you the scroll, human. Or a piece of it, now that it has been scattered to the four winds.
The burning red gaze slid back to Suki, and he smiled slowly, showing fangs.
I will do so after I collect my payment.
Good. Lady Satomi stepped back as the first drops of rain began to fall.
I am counting on you, Yaburama. I am sure there are others who are scrambling to find all the pieces of the dragon scroll. You know what to do if you meet them. Well, she opened a pink parasol and swung it over her head. I leave it to you. Enjoy.
As sheets of water began creeping across the courtyard, Lady Satomi turned and began walking away. Suki screamed into the gag and threw herself after her mistress, crying and begging, praying to the kami and anyone else who would hear.
Please, she thought desperately. Please, I cannot die like this. Not like this.
Lady Satomi paused and glanced back at her with a smile.
Oh, don't be sad, little Suki-chan, she said. This is your proudest moment. You will be the catalyst to usher in a whole new era. This empire, the whole world, will change because of your sacrifice today. See?
The lady tilted her head, observing her as if she were a whimpering puppy.
You've actually become useful. Surely that is enough for someone like you.
Behind Suki, the ground trembled, and a huge claw closed on her legs, curved talons sinking into her skin. She screamed and thrashed, yanking at the ropes, trying to writhe out of the demon's grip. But there was no escape. Lady Satomi sniffed, turned, and continued on, her parasol bobbing through the rain. As Suki was pulled toward the Oni, the minor demons shrieking and dancing around her.
Help me! Someone, please, help me! Daisuke-sama!
Abruptly, her thoughts went to the noble, to his handsome face and gentle smile, though she knew he would not be coming. No one was coming, because no one cared about the death of a lowly servant girl.
Father,
Suki thought in numb despair.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to leave you alone.
Deep inside, anger flickered, momentarily snuffing the fear. It was terribly unfair, being killed by a demon before she could do anything. She was only a servant, but she had hoped to marry a good man, raise a family, leave something behind that mattered.
I'm not ready, Suki thought in desperation. I'm not ready to go. Please, not yet.
Clawed fingers closed around her neck, and she was lifted up to face the Oni's terrible, hungry smile. Its hot breath, smelling of smoke and rotten meat, blasted her face as the demon opened its jaws. Mercifully, the gods decided to intervene at that moment, and Suki finally fainted in terror, her consciousness leaving her body the moment before it was torn in half. The scent of blood misted into the air, and the demons howled in glee. From Suki's mangled body, unseen by the horde and invisible to normal eyes, a small sphere of light rose slowly into the air. It hovered over the grisly scene, seeming to watch as the minor demons squabbled over scraps, Yaburama's booming roar rising into the night as he swatted them away. For a moment, it seemed to torn between flying into the clouds and remaining where it was. Drifting aimlessly higher, it paused at a flash of color that gleamed through the rain. A pink parasol heading toward the doors of the castle. The sphere's blue-white glow flared into an angry red. Zipping from the sky, the orb of light flew soundlessly over the head of the Oni, dropped lower to the ground and slipped through the door to the castle, just before it creaked shut. Leaving the Oni, the demons, and the torn, murdered body of a servant girl behind.
2. The Fox in the Temple.
Yumeko!
The shout echoed over the garden, booming and furious, making me wince. I'd been sitting quietly by the pond, tossing crumbs to the fat red and white fish that swarmed below the surface, when the familiar sound of my name bellowed in anger rang from the direction of the temple. Quickly, I ducked behind the large stone lantern at the edge of the water, just as Denga stalked around the opposite bank, his face like a thundercloud.
Yumeko!
The monk shouted again as I pressed into the rough, mossy stone. I could picture his normally stern, placid face turning as red as the temple pillars, the flush creeping all the way up his bald forehead. I'd seen it too many times to count. His braided ponytail and orange robes were no doubt flapping as he spun, searching the edges of the pond, scanning the bamboo patches surrounding the garden.
I know you're here somewhere, he raged, putting salt in the teapot again. Do you think Nitoru likes having tea spat right in his face?
I bit my lip to stifle the laughter and pressed against the statue, trying to be silent.
Wretched demon girl,
Denga seethed as the sound of his footsteps turned from the pond and headed farther into the garden.
I know you're laughing your fool head off now. When I find you, you'll be sweeping the floors until the hour of the rat.
His voice drifted away. I peeked around the stone to watch Denga continue down the path into the bamboo until he was lost from sight. Blowing out a breath, I leaned against the lantern's weathered body, feeling triumphant. Well, that was entertaining. Denga-san is always so uptight, he really needs to try out new expressions or his face will crack from the strain. I grinned, imagining the look on poor Nitoru's face when the other monk discovered what was in his teacup. Unfortunately, Nitoru had the same sense of humor Denga did, which was none at all. Definitely time to make myself scarce. I'll steal a book from the library and go hide under the desk. Oh, wait. But Denga already knows that spot. Bad idea. I cringed at the thought of all the long wooden verandas that would need a thorough sweeping if I was found. Maybe it's a good day to not be here. At least until this evening. I wonder what the monkey family in the forest is doing today. Excitement fluttered. A dozen or so yellow monkeys lived within the branches of an ancient cedar that rose above all other trees in the forest. On clear days, if one climbed to the very top, one could see the whole world, from the tiny farming village at the base of the mountains, all the way to the distant horizon. Whenever I found myself at the top of that tree, swaying with the monkeys and the branches, I would gaze over the multicolored carpet stretching away before me and wonder if today would be the day I'd be brave enough to see what lay beyond the skyline. I never was, and this afternoon would be no different. But at least I wouldn't be here, waiting for an angry Denga-san to shove a broom into my hands and tell me to sweep every flat surface in the temple, including the yard. Drawing back from the statue, I turned around and came face to face with Master Isao. I yelped, jerking back and hitting the stone lantern, which was bigger and heavier than I and obstinately refused to budge. The ancient, white-bearded monk smiled serenely under his wide-brimmed straw hat.
Going somewhere, Yumeko-chan?
I stammered, rubbing the back of my head. Master Isao wasn't a large man. Thin and spindly, he stood a head shorter than me when he was wearing his wooden geta clogs. But no one in the temple was more respected, and no one had such control over his ki as Master Isao. I'd seen him chop a tree in half with a flick of his hand and punch a giant boulder into rubble. He was the undisputed master of the Silent Winds Temple, able to quiet a room of strong-willed ki practitioners just by appearing. Though he never raised his voice or appeared angry, the harshest expression I'd ever seen him make was a mild frown, and that had been terrifying. "Ano," I stammered again as his bushy eyebrows rose in patient amusement. No use in lying, Master Isao always knew everything about everything. "I was going to visit the monkey family in the forest, Master Isao," I confessed, figuring that was the least of my crimes. I wasn't exactly forbidden to leave the temple grounds, but the monks certainly didn't like it when I did. The amount of chores, training, and duties they imposed on me when I was awake indicated that they tried to keep me busy whenever possible. The only free time I could get was usually stolen, like today. Master Isao only smiled. "Ah, monkeys. Well, I am afraid your friends will have to wait a bit, Yumeko-chan," he said, not sounding angry or surprised at all. "I must borrow your time for a moment. Please, follow me." He turned and started around the pond, heading toward the temple. I dusted off my sleeves and fell into step behind him, down the bamboo trail dappled by sun and green shadows, past the singing stones where the breeze hummed playfully through the holes worn into the rocks, and over the red-arched bridge that spanned the stream. A drab-brown bird flitted to the branches of a juniper tree, puffed out its chest, and filled the air with the beautiful warbling song of a nightingale. I whistled back at him, and he gave me an indignant look before darting into the leaves. The trees opened up, the foliage falling away as we walked past the tiny rock garden with its meticulously raked sand and up the steps of the temple. As we entered the dim, cool hall, I spotted Nitoru glaring at me across the room and dared a cheeky wave, knowing he would not approach while I was with Master Isao. I'd probably be sweeping the steps until next winter, but the look on the monk's face was worth it. Master Isao led me through several narrow hallways, passing individual rooms on either side, until he slid back a door panel and motioned me through. I stepped into a familiar room, small and neat, empty but for a large standing mirror on the opposite wall and a hanging wall scroll beside it. The scroll depicted a massive dragon soaring over a raging sea and a tiny boat tossed by the waves beneath it. I masked a sigh. I'd been in this room a few times before, and the ritual that followed was always the same. Knowing what Master Isao wanted, I walked lightly across the tatami mats and knelt in front of the mirror, the only one in the entire temple. Master Isao followed and settled himself beside it, facing me, his hands in his lap. For a moment he sat there, eyes serene, though it felt like his gaze passed right through me to the wall behind my head. "What do you see?" he asked, as he always did. I looked at the mirror. My reflection gazed back at me, a slight girl of 16 winters, straight black hair falling, unbound, to the center of her back. She wore straw sandals, a white sash, and a short crimson kimono that was tattered in places, especially the long, billowy sleeves. Her hands were grubby from kneeling at the pond talking to the fish, and dirt stained her knees and face. At first glance, she looked like a ragged but perfectly normal peasant girl, perhaps a fisherman's or farmer's waif, kneeling on the floor of the temple. If you didn't happen to notice the bushy orange tail peeking out from behind her robes, and the large, triangular, black-tipped ears poking up from the top of her skull, and the glowing golden eyes that very clearly marked her as not normal, not human at all. "I see myself, Master Isao," I said, wondering if, this time, it was the right answer. "In my true form, without illusion or barrier, I see a kitsune." Kitsune, fox, or half kitsune, more accurately. Wild kitsune, the foxes that roamed the hidden places of Iwagoto, were masters of illusion, magic, and shapeshifting. While it was true that some kitsune chose to live as normal wild animals, all foxes possessed magic. Kitsune were yokai, creatures of the supernatural. One of their favorite tricks was to take human form, usually in the guise of a beautiful woman, and lure men astray. To the naked eye, I was an ordinary human girl. No tail, pointed ears, or yellow eyes. Only in front of mirrors and reflective surfaces was my true nature revealed. Lacquered tables, still water, even the edge of a blade. I had to be very careful where I stood and what I was around, lest an acute observer notice the reflection on the surface did not quite match the girl in front of it. Or so the monks warned me. They all knew what I was, and made certain to remind me of it often. Half-blood, demon child, fox girl, phrases that were part of my everyday life. Not that any of the monks were cruel or heartless, just practical. I was kitsune, something not quite human, and they saw no reason to pretend otherwise. I glanced at Master Isao, wondering if he would tell me anything different this time, any hint of what he really wanted me to say. We'd played the what-do-you-see game numerous times in the past, and none of my answers, be they human, demon, fox, or fish, seemed to satisfy him, because I'd always find myself right back here, staring at the kitsune in the mirror. "How are your lessons progressing?" Master Isao went on, giving no indication that he'd heard my answer, or if it was the right one. I very seriously doubted it. "Fine, Master Isao."
"Show me."
I hesitated, casting about for a suitable target. There weren't many to be found. The mirror, perhaps, or the wall scroll. But I had already used both in the past, and Master Isao wouldn't be impressed with the same tricks over and over again. This, too, was a game we'd played often. I spotted a yellow maple leaf caught on the end of my sleeve and grinned. Picking it up, I twirled it between fingers and thumb, then carefully put it on my head. Kitsune magic needed an anchor, something of the natural world, to build an illusion around. There were stories of very old, very powerful kitsune who could weave illusions out of thin air, but I needed something to attach the magic to. Focal point in place, I half-closed my eyes and called on my powers. Since before I could remember, magic had come naturally to me, a gift from the yokai side of the family, I was told. Even when I was a toddler, I had shown impressive talent for it, floating little balls of kitsune-bi, the heatless blue-white foxfire, through the halls of the temple. As I'd gotten older and my magic had grown, a few of the monks thought Master Isao should put a binding on me, sealing away my power so I wouldn't hurt anyone or myself. Wild kitsune were notorious troublemakers. They weren't inherently malicious, but their pranks could range from merely annoying, stealing food or hiding small items, to truly dangerous, spooking a horse on a narrow mountain path, or leading someone deep into a marsh or forest, never to be seen again. Better that I didn't have that temptation, at least according to Denga and a few others. But the master of the Silent Winds Temple had adamantly refused. Fox magic was part of a kitsune's life, he said, something as natural as sleeping or breathing. To deny it would do more harm than good. Instead, I practiced my magic every day with a monk called Satoshi in the hopes that I would learn to control my fox-given talent and not the other way around. The monks had been skeptical at first, but I knew Master Isao trusted that I would not use my powers for mischief, so I tried not to give in to temptation. Even though some days, it was very hard not to disguise the cat as a teapot, or to make a closed door look open, or to turn a log invisible in front of the steps. Fox magic was nothing but illusion and trickery, Denga-san had seethed on more than one occasion, usually on the tail end of a prank. Nothing useful could ever come of it. That might be true, I thought, as the heat of the fox magic rose up inside me. But it certainly is a lot of fun. A ripple went through me, like my body was made of water that someone had just dropped a pebble into, and a puff of white smoke engulfed me from the ground up. As the tendrils of smoke dissipated, I opened my eyes and smiled at the image in the mirror. Master Isao stared back at me in the reflection, a perfect replica of the man sitting beside the mirror, if you didn't count the rather smug grin on his weathered face, and the white-tipped tail behind him. The real Master Isao chuckled and shook his head. "Is this what you and Satoshi have been practicing?" he asked. "I shudder to imagine the day. I suggest Denga-san should go and catch a monkey." "Ooh, do you think he would? That would be hilarious. Not that I would ever do something like that, of course." Reaching up, I plucked the maple leaf from my head, and the illusion frayed apart, fox magic scattering to the wind, until I was just me once more. Twirling the leaf in my fingers, I wondered how much trouble I'd be in if I did disguise myself as Master Isao and told Denga to go jump in the pond. Knowing the monk's fanatical devotion to his master, he would do it without question. And then he'd probably kill me.
16 years,
Master Isao remarked in a soft voice. I blinked at him. That was new. Normally, by this time, our conversation would be over, and he'd be instructing me to return to my duties.
16 years to the day that you have been with us,
he went on, almost wistfully.
Since we found you outside the gate in a fish basket, with nothing but a tattered robe and a note pinned to the cloth. Forgive me, but I must leave this child in your care, the letter said. Do not judge her harshly. She cannot help what she is, and the road I walk is no place for innocence. Her name is Yumeko, child of dreams. Raise her well, and may the great dragon guide your steps and hers.
I nodded politely, having heard this story dozens of times. I'd never known my father or my mother, and hadn't given either of them much thought. They weren't a part of my life, and I saw no point in worrying about things I could not change. Though there was one very hazy memory from when I was just a toddler that continued to haunt my dreams. I'd been wandering the woods outside the temple that day, hiding from the monks and chasing squirrels, when I'd felt eyes on me from behind. I'd turned and seen a white fox staring at me from atop a fallen log, yellow eyes glowing in the shadows. We'd watched each other for a long moment, child and Kitsune, and even though I was very young, I had felt a kinship with this creature, a sense of longing that I didn't understand. But when I'd taken a step toward it, the fox had disappeared. I'd never glimpsed it again.
16 years, Master Isao continued, unaware of my thoughts. And in that time, we have taught you our ways, steered you down what we hoped was the right path, trained you to seek the balance between human and Kitsune. You have always known what you are. We have never hidden the truth. I have witnessed both the fox's cunning and human compassion within you. I have seen callousness and kindness in equal measure, and I know you are balanced on a very thin edge right now, one of yokai and human. Whatever you choose, whatever path you wish to take, even if you attempt to traverse them both, you must decide for yourself, soon. It is almost time. He didn't give any explanation of what he meant. He didn't ask me if I understood. Maybe he knew that half the time I could never untangle his riddles, and the other half I really wasn't listening. But I nodded and smiled, like I knew what he was getting at, and said, "Yes, Master Isao, I understand." He sighed and shook his head. "You have no idea what I'm babbling on about, child," he stated, making me wince. "But that is all right. It is not the reason I brought you here today." He looked away, his gaze going distant, that shadow falling over his eyes once more. "You are nearly grown, and the world outside is changing. It is time you knew our true purpose, what the Silent Winds Temple truly protects." I blinked, and in the mirror, the kitsune's ears twitched forward. "What we protect?" I asked. "I didn't know we protected anything." "Of course not," Master Isao agreed. "No one ever told you. It is our greatest secret. But it is one you must know. The dragon is rising, and another age comes to an end." "A very long time ago," Master Isao began in the lyrical tones of a master storyteller, "there was a mortal, a young lord who commanded a great army and had servants that outnumbered the grains of rice in the field. His name has been lost to legend, but it is said he was an arrogant, foolish human who wished to become an immortal kami, a god. To this end, he assembled his greatest warriors and ordered them to bring him the Fushi no Tama, a jewel that was said to grant immortality to any who possessed it. Unfortunately, the jewel of immortality resided in the forehead of the great dragon that lived under the sea. But the Lord coveted immortality and told his warriors to retrieve Fushi no Tama by whatever means possible. His retainers, a little more sensible than their master, pretended to set off on this quest at once, and so sure of their success was the Lord that he adorned his rooms with gold and silver and draped silken cloth over the roof of his house, as was befitting a god. Several months passed with no word, and the young lord, growing impatient, journeyed to the sacred cliffs of Yugake, where it was said the dragon lived beneath the waves. As it turned out, not one of his warriors had taken a boat to search for the dragon, but had fled the province at first opportunity. Angry at this news, the lord threw caution to the winds, hired a helmsman and a ship, and embarked on the quest himself. As soon as the unfortunate ship reached deep ocean, a fierce storm blew in, and the sea turned on the Lord and his crew like an enraged beast. To make matters worse, the Lord was struck with a terrible sickness and lay close to death while the sea raged and howled around them.
As the storm grew in ferocity and the ship itself threatened to break apart, the helmsman cried out that surely the gods were angry with them.